Do you feel like you learned something from Simon?
I think that I learned something, but also more importantly, I understand how this policy piece plays in the larger Canadian science policy ecosystem.
Yes.
And it's just interesting to kind of see the stuff that we see, that we read on the news, and as scientists see how that relates to us, but also how it relates to these Canadian values of inclusion and of just not being jerks. Welcome to Do You Even Science, a podcast where we discuss what's happening in Canadian science and policy and everything in between. We're your hosts. I'm Simon Landry, and I have with me Dina Hamza. And today we're going to be talking about science policy. Dina, before we start, do you know what science policy means? Can you describe it to me, please?
I think I know what science policy means. I think it's taking, bridging our research and our findings, developing an evidence base, taking that evidence base to develop guidelines. I think of policy as like guidelines for us to follow. So to implement, for example, in my case, healthcare, there's a policy for certain ways of treatment or certain aspects of access, and it's governed by this policy.
Right. Do you think that like it kind of, so last or 2 weeks ago with Matt, we were talking about how communications kind of, or science communication ends this loop for science. So you've got the research aspect, you've got the sharing aspect, and so I guess science policy also
is like the next step, right?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be the next step? So I think the way that we communicate things to people who aren't in the research world is one way to help foster the development of policies. I think that's how I look at it.
Right. So I guess like if ultimately you think like that, I could read a science article, like a popular science article, and say, oh, geez, I should waste less, or I should stop throwing plastic in the ocean.
Yeah.
I might change my personal behavior, but if then that changes kind of a nation's policy, the way that a nation does stuff, then that's kind of the ultimate way science can have an impact, I guess.
Absolutely. Yeah. I agree.
So perfect. We've defined science policy. Good. Next, what's the other thing that we need to define?
But I think that's important, Simon, because I think we do throw around terms such as, you know, I'm interested in policy, or we should have a policy about this or that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that perhaps everyone knows or is aware of all the steps that go into the development of a policy.
I think this is one of those things where everybody uses this word or tends to use this word, but not a lot of people know what it is. Kind of like a research chair that.
I agree.
So a research chair is one of those things that everybody's heard about. It's like, ooh, they have a research chair in like developmental neurocognition or something. And you're like, wow, that sounds like a big deal. But I couldn't define it. You can define it. We put it
up. I don't think I could define it. And actually, one of my mentors is the research chair.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about it, and I was trying to like define. I'm trying to group together all the things that he does.
Yeah.
And at the end, it's like I don't have this like 2-sentence job description. Like I'm still not quite sure.
No. So
what it is they do.
Yeah. So if somebody is listening, when I put out this quiz or questionnaire a poll on Twitter, two people said they didn't know what it was. Two people said they did know what it was. I think we were the two people who didn't know what it was.
It was totally me. I was like, nope, I don't know.
So I think that either we're the only two people in like the academic world that, I don't know. Anyway, from my understanding,
maybe we're the only two honest people who were willing to be like, yeah, I'm willing to be vulnerable right now.
Yeah.
I don't know what this means.
Exactly. It's part of the learning process. Maybe we can have a research chair podcast later.
I can convince my mentor to come on.
Exactly. But science policy is one of those things where I think it's like a goal of a lot of the research and a lot of the sort of institutional level research. But when it comes to actually understanding what it is, I think there's, like anything that exists in that political realm, it's really hard to say, oh, this is science policy.
But you know what I also find challenging, Simon, is in some of the literature that I've come across, it's that the evidence base guides policy, or it's that policy guides the development of an evidence base.
Yeah.
And I think for me as an academic, I see it as, well, you need the evidence base first.
Mm-hmm.
To then guide the development of a policy.
Yeah.
So how does that work if you have a policy first? Like, what is the basis of this policy if you don't have the evidence supporting it?
Yeah. And
have you heard that phrase before, that, you know, evidence guides policy or policy guides the evidence base?
I haven't heard that phrase, but it makes a lot of sense and it fits. So I'm on this kick of kind of, so my PhD was in multi-sensory integration, so there was a lot of seeing the difference between what's objective and subjective.
Right.
And so research and science is very much subjective. We could, you know, someone could, two people could see the same results and have different interpretations.
Absolutely.
And so I guess that goes to what you were saying, where if, like, the governmental framework is looking to do a certain thing with a certain result, then you does policy guide research? I don't know. I'm getting mixed up.
Well, maybe it's that there would be some research in an area which would then guide the development of a policy, but it's not a solid evidence base yet.
Right.
Maybe? Like, I think that's how I would see it.
I guess what we're discovering is that it's a lot more fallible than I guess we would expect it to be.
And it's so complex.
Yeah, it is. It is.
So complex.
So before we launch into kind of the meat of this episode, which is what was it called? Between the legs, between the ears?
Between the ears or between the legs.
So good.
I actually get to teach Simon something today, which is exciting. Very exciting.
So before we get into that, with my work at York University, one of our researchers is a concussion researcher. And in Ontario right now, there's a public consultation for a new concussion education policy law. And so I'm actually working through this process of getting a researcher's input heard in the provincial kind of policy world.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's super
interesting.
How's
that going?
Even in order to get to the point where I knew what to tell my researcher, I had to kind of understand the network of senior policy advisors.
And that's a whole different world.
Yeah, it's
a different world.
It's unreal. It's huge. And so finally, I have my ask for my researcher, and I hope that it kind of aligns with what she was expecting, and hopefully we can have an impact on this policy. That's exciting.
So you're actually right on the front lines.
Yeah, I'm there. The deadline's I think Monday, so we'll see. See how that plays out.
Okay.
All right. So Dina, what is it that you want to talk about today, that you want to teach me?
Okay, so it's between the ears or between the legs. So it's the intersection of gender identity and policy. So as you know, Simon, I consider myself, and I tend to feel a little bit uncomfortable sometimes when I speak about things. So in this case, I am saying that I am an LGBTQ ally.
Oh.
I don't know if I can really... I feel like sometimes this topic is uncomfortable. In that, I don't know, can I call myself that? Do I have to be invited to be called that? In any case, I have
I've been invited, by the way, so I'm definitely an ally.
You've been invited?
I've been invited.
Okay, so I think I've been invited, but I'm not really sure. So close friend and colleague, Dr. Christopher Wells, who's the assistant professor and faculty director with the Institute for Sexual Minority Studies and Services at the University of Alberta, we have had lovely conversations about gender identity, sexual orientation. I feel very comfortable talking to him about, I can ask him any question. And I've learned so much. I mean, for example, the H word that used to be used to identify lesbian or gay individuals is now a derogatory term.
Oh.
Did you know that, Simon?
I did not know that.
So the opposite of heterosexual is actually derogatory.
Huh.
And I didn't know that. And that was just through a conversation with he's Dr. Christopher Wells, but I just call him Chris.
Oh, well, you guys are pal. Or you two. Oh, another thing, saying you guys, just like as an aside, and I've noticed this.
So true.
Saying you guys is such like, it's a small thing, but when you start noticing it, why would I have said you guys for you and Chris, your pal Chris? You're a woman. I shouldn't have said guys.
I don't know. Yeah. Like these are little nuances, right? Yeah. These little things that we say. I noticed actually at a conference that I just came from in Halifax a few days ago, they were still using ladies and gentlemen, which it's supposed to be the appropriate term or the inclusive term is distinguished guests.
Oh.
So you no longer say ladies and gentlemen.
Right.
You say distinguished guests.
Huh. Interesting.
So yeah, I think there's, but at that same conference in Halifax, there's a brand new conference center. I should have snapped a photo of it for the bathroom.
Right.
They had an inclusive sign.
Okay. What does that look like?
So it had it has the symbols for male, female, and transgender.
Is it the kind of the, I don't even know how to describe it. It's like a circle with a little arrow and the little T, but all in
So it had like the circle and it had arrow, and then one had like a plus sign, so that's like male, female, and then it had the transgender one, which I believe is like with two lines or something along the. I should have snapped a picture of it, but I recall running to a session and I was like, oh, inclusive sign. Yes. Inclusive signage.
Then you were like, guys, and that's guys, a huge, did you notice? No.
Oh, and I, no, and you know, yeah, and you know, I had mentioned it to a colleague, but I think I was the only one that was like, woo, this is awesome. Like, I think they were like, yeah, that's great. That's great, Dina. Pat on the back. Yeah. Carry on.
So to go back to this, to how we got on this topic of being allied, kind of being certified allies for...
I am like not certified at all. Well, I want to be. I have an interest, Simon, in... so my main interests are healthcare access, appropriate treatments, specific to addiction and mental health treatment, because that's just what my PhD is in psychiatry.
Right.
And that's what I'm most interested in. But it's focusing on those underserved populations, and the LGBTQ population is different than the general population in that they have challenges accessing, and not just addiction and mental health treatment. It's regular, like how you or I can just walk into our family physician. That is a challenge for some people in that group.
Yeah.
They deal with a lot more stigma. They deal with, the challenge of being freely open.
Right. And I'm really excited, or I'm not excited, that's the wrong word, curious to see what you'll have to say, because there's this notion of, I guess like paternalism, is that the right word? For where people who aren't trans or whatever being like, oh, I'm an expert on this, so I will dictate policy.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And it's this idea that if we are developing research studies and if we are developing policies, we need to have that lived experience.
Right.
And
right.
So even for me, as a preface for the rest of this conversation, my information is purely from literature and articles. I don't feel that I am in a place to speak for LGBTQ population, because I don't have that lived experience.
Right.
So it's me talking about something that I haven't lived.
Yeah. And I wonder, of those articles and things that form your perspective, how many of those, because like, if you write an article, if I was to write an article, but I've sort of done my research and I have a bunch of primary sources, ultimately, right. It would be my like straight white male perspective that would be that would like permeate through this article.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
then, but then
it's like this unconscious bias. Yeah, like there's all these things that play into it. Yeah. I think what I tend to focus on though, Simon, and again, this is part because of what I specialize in, but also my own interest. I love reading about someone else's experience.
Right.
Like hearing the voice of someone else. So a lot of the articles that I've sought out are articles where it has information provided from an individual with lived experience.
Right, right. Okay.
And I think that's much more compelling.
Yeah,
to me,
absolutely.
It's much more compelling.
All right, well, let's stop talking about how I feel about stuff. And
so Simon, but do you know what what between the ears or between the legs, like, do you know what that's about? Have you heard that phrase before?
I haven't heard that phrase, but I bought the episode of Scientific American, I think, that was it was like a big thing. It was like, this is not, I have it behind me. I'll grab it. But it's like, this is not a woman's issue. And it was about kind of how gender is, it just basically talked about gender. So yes, I read a magazine once about it. So I'm like super informed.
So really it's between the ears is really your gender identity. Between the legs is what you were born with. Mm-hmm. What could be written on your birth certificate, which we know things are changing. So mm-hmm. on your birth certificate as a parent, in some, I don't recall exactly which place. I'm thinking it might've been, I don't know if it was in the US, but there was a mother who decided that there would be no gender, or sex, I should say. See, even I'm
Dina,
I'm using
slipping.
these terms interchange. Look at this, sex listed on the birth certificate. So things are changing. We're progressing.
Right. So, so can you, again, can you just so it's like clear in everybody's minds, what is sex and what is gender?
Sex is your biological parts.
Right.
And gender is how you identify. So I could be biologically female, but I identify, so this would be my gender, I identify as male.
Okay.
That would be my gender. Okay. So just as an aside here, Simon, as I mentioned earlier, I've been working with students, training them on data extraction for scoping reviews, systematic reviews. And what we found that was really interesting and a challenge is that gender and sex, those terms are used interchangeably within research. And so when we are extracting data, in some cases, some manuscripts say gender, male, female, and then others, it will say sex, male, female. And so I think as we're progressing, I think there will be a change even in the way that we report research, in that we'll be clear in the terms of what is sex and what is gender.
Do you think that should, those kind of parameters should also be applied in scientific research that has nothing to do with gender identity and more fundamental
investigations? But I think if you're going to report that, right, if you're going to report that, then aren't you making the assumption if you see somebody that, if you see somebody that is visually female, they could be transgender.
Right. Well, they would
self-report. But what if they don't choose to be? What if they don't? Yeah, they would self-report.
Yeah. Right. And I guess that also.
But then if you're asking your sex, what if they, I guess if they know the difference between sex and gender.
Yeah. And it's
as the individual.
And like this is another, we really need to stop stalling. I have so many questions for you for
this
topic.
This is great though.
Yeah.
This is great.
But kind of
teach Simon Day.
So many questions. But this idea that this affects, I think, like point, what was it, like 0.6% of the Canadian population. And so, like, where these, obviously we want policies to be as inclusive as possible. Yeah. And ultimately we want society to represent everybody, especially the people who don't have voices. Right. But it's so easy. Also, I use but, I try to use and. And it's so easy to say, yeah, why are we putting so much effort and resources better understanding a population that ultimately is 0.6% of Canada, if that.
But there's still people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So even if you had just one person mm-hmm. in all of Canada mm-hmm. that fit in that particular category, there's still one person.
Yeah.
And they still need to have rights. They That's still true. Need to be protected. And, you know, there are three areas, Simon, I don't know if you're fully aware about this part, but there are three areas that influence positive mental health and well-being.
Mm.
And the first is social inclusion.
Right.
The second is freedom from discrimination and violence.
Mm-hmm.
And the third is access to economic resources.
Right.
So I think if you're in that 0.6%, your well-being can be affected because you won't feel social inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have social inclusion, well, are you free from discrimination?
Yeah.
Even if you self-discriminate, right? Even if you there's the idea of self-stigma and self-discrimination.
Yeah.
I think that even if it's one person within Canada.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I definitely agree with that. I'm very much, I believe in kind of the
devil's advocate. Are you devil's advocate, Simon?
I don't want to say devil's advocate, but it's like very, it's such an easy, sort of argument to make, and it's a little bit lazy, but kind of to say, like, why should we care about these people if it's just two or three people?
I think it takes putting yourself in their position.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's that idea of having empathy for others.
Yeah.
And if you are able to actually put yourself in the position of someone else, you would see that, well, that would be a challenging life, even if it's one person in Canada.
Right.
But so now you know the difference between, you know, gender, sex, very rustic
yes.
definitions.
So
one of the things that I found really interesting in my line of research, so I already told you that, you know, they're an underserved population in terms of access and mm-hmm. having treatment that is inclusive and treatment that is specific for their needs. You know, even with LGBTQ youth, they have, like, there's some reports. This one specifically from Homewood Health in Alberta, which this was released last month, April 2018. Homewood Health is a program that provides support, inpatient and outpatient support for addiction and mental health. And in their report, they state that, you know, LGBTQ youth face approximately 14 times the risk of suicide and substance abuse than their heterosexual peers.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a group that is in need of services that cater to them.
Right.
So what was interesting is at the end of 2017, Canada's prison system launched a policy, or actually enacted a policy specific to transgender inmates.
Okay.
Did you come across that article, Simon?
I did, because you sent it to me.
But what about before I sent it to you?
I actually had heard about it. I think
you had heard about it?
Yeah.
Do you remember what the overall?
It has to do, I want to say, with Bill C-16.
Okay.
Is that right? Am I in the right?
I don't even recall the bill, but I just recall the details.
Yeah,
so the details are. Go ahead, Simon. Quiz.
I was really hoping you were going to jump in, and then
okay, I'll just.
That's what.
Yeah, you just say. Totally cut me off.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for exposing me.
I will continue. So, with this policy, if you are a transgender inmate in the Canadian prison system, you will be housed based on your gender identity mm-hmm. and not by the sex that is listed on your birth certificate.
Hmm.
And, you know, there's an article 2 days ago from a transgender woman in Oregon, in the United States. And apparently they're more progressive than other states
Okay.
And they're beginning to see that transgender inmates require different approaches than what are currently in place. They haven't made any changes, but within this article, there's this transgender woman who details assaults within, you know, being housed in the male facility because her birth certificate lists her as male, not having the privacy when showering or using the washroom, and constant harassment and bullying because of her gender identity. So this is something that is occurring currently. And I was really proud of Canada at that. When I read that article, I was really proud of Canada that, okay, so we've enacted this policy as of December 2017.
Right.
And not only will they be housed where they identify, they will be able to, any pronouns they choose, they will be referred to with that pronoun, with the name they choose. In that article in Oregon, that wasn't the case.
Right.
This transgender woman was not allowed to be referred by the pronouns she chose or the name that she chose.
So it's clear, if I was born, and I hope I don't come off like just not racist, but I hope I express myself in a sensitive way.
I think it's important, Simon, just as an aside.
Yeah.
Dr. Christopher Wells, yeah, you know, I've learned a lot from him, and he has said, you know, it's all about how you have the conversation.
Okay.
It's about how you present it. And if you're just trying to seek information and you want to be supportive of this particular community, try not to be so worried about any backlash or how somebody will interpret what you're saying.
All right. So there will be an episode 4, regardless of how I express myself with this.
Yes.
Perfect. yeah. So if I'm born with male, with a like male reproductive organs,
right.
So that would be my sex. But if my gender was female, and I would kind of not feel comfortable in my own body.
Right.
And so I would, I guess, go through gender reassignment
If you choose. Not everyone chooses to have reassignment surgery.
Okay. And so I would then commit a crime if I don't, let's say I don't do gender reassignment surgery or procedures.
Sex reassignment surgery.
Yeah. Yes. And then I would commit a crime. And so I would identify as a woman, but have male sex organs.
Right.
And I would be put in a woman's facilities.
That's right. Within Canada, you would be put in the women's. Part of it, Simon, is, well, how do we protect this particular inmate?
Yeah, and well, I'm thinking like the inmate, and as well as kind of like, I guess, would people feel uncomfortable with, like, would the women that are in the prison, kind of whose interests or whose concerns do you put first?
Well, it's it's both. But if they I think that's a challenge,
because it's a huge,
if you have someone that is then identifying as a woman with male organs,
yes,
and then is the sexual orientation, so that's the next part, the sexual orientation that they're bisexual or a lesbian, then how does that, and I think one of the challenges within the corrections systems anyway is the intimate relationships that can occur. And I think there's no preventing that.
Right.
I think the key is it consensual?
Right. Yes.
So it would be consensual on the part of the individual who is transgender, as well as, is it consensual from the other party? So I think that's where the challenge is would this be consensual?
Yeah, it's a really difficult policy piece where I feel like
it's a policy, you know, Simon. You know, I was really happy that the policy was put into place because that is protection of rights and the freedoms of someone who is transgender. But at the same time, there was no talk about extra training of corrections officers. So how do you, we've enacted this policy, but are all of the pieces in place? And I find that in general, like our healthcare system, we're not very proactive. Mm-hmm. So this didn't seem like a proactive stepped approach.
Right.
Leading into the development of a policy, like train your corrections officers in inclusive language and the protection, added protection of these individuals. So within the Canadian policy, transgender inmates, so let's say your example, how they would be housed, this individual identifies as a woman and would be housed in the women's section, they would still have privacy rights in terms of using the washrooms, the showers. They would have added privacy because of their current situation.
I guess like the
and access to healthcare, like when we're thinking about healthcare, we're like, you get sick, do you get your medicine? Well, with you know, transgender inmates, we're talking about hormone replacement, hormone therapy,
right,
and perhaps even sex reassignment.
I think that
and actually it's not supposed to be reassignment. Did you know it's actually supposed to be called sex reaffirmation?
I did not know that.
That's affirming what you already, what you already feel.
Oh, that's neat. I think the first time that I was exposed to kind of this, what we're talking about, was with Chelsea Manning. I forget what her name was before, but
Great advocate for the cause. There's Marnie Panis. There's many people, many transgender women who are great advocates.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's a lot of transgender males, men as well.
I guess, yeah. So, yeah, I guess, like, what I'm starting to understand about this whole topic is really, this is a conversation that's just starting. Like, being, it's like anything. If we're able to have the conversation, then we can kind of put some fundamental processes and policies in place. But this isn't, like, we're not done.
No. And I think this is just the start. And, once this policy is enacted, I mean, you have to see, I think there's a component of, and I know that I'm saying that it wasn't necessarily so proactive and that we don't have the training or at least it wasn't explicitly stated that there's an overhaul, you know, with Starbucks and, you know, the recent controversy with Starbucks and arresting two individuals based on race.
Uh-huh.
And now, you know, all Starbucks locations are closed for one day of inclusive training. I mean, there was no explicit statement that Corrections Canada is going to do this overhaul with their staff on how to be more inclusive. Perhaps that has happened, but it's just not explicitly or transparent. But I think that is a work in progress. And I think as we enact these policies or make changes, there are going to be some lessons learned along the way.
Right.
And then modifying.
Yeah. And that kind of feeds into the cycle of science policy communications, where we're going to find stuff out. Probably we, like, in 10 years, we'll look back and be like, geez, can you even believe we did this? What a misstep. But from that, we'll get information and we'll get kind of the grounds on which to test these hypotheses and to perform the scientific process, and then hopefully we'll kind of develop something that's better for everybody.
I agree. So I think this move toward this policy, it does enhance social inclusion. It's this, you know, trying to reduce any discrimination or violence that can occur to individuals. They have access to all the resources that they need within the corrections facilities. So really, this will work toward enhancing their mental health and overall well-being.
Yeah. And I read an interesting article, I think, last week where, and we're not going to get into this in detail, but basically the idea was the Quebec City mosque shooting.
Yeah.
The judge is faced with this incredible dilemma, or I don't know if it's a dilemma, decision, where either they choose to lock him away for like a million years or how many hundreds of years, or do we say, hey, the way justice in Canada works is that it's made to rehabilitate people. And so,
yeah, and that's a huge insane,
yeah.
Yeah.
But like,
I just sounded like Donald Trump right now.
It's huge. Right? but like when you look at kind of these policies in Canadian prisons, I guess ultimately what we want is to make everybody feel good. So not feel good, but like feel not excluded from this process so that eventually they can be reintegrated within Canadian society.
Yeah. You want to work toward, like you said, rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm.
That's, and like restitution and yeah. so on. That's the component that is most important.
Yeah.
So they do have to have access to services. They have to have access to, you know, improving education, vocational yeah. type things, all of that.
Yeah. And I was reading through the comments of, I think, a CBC article that you sent me, and a lot of it was super negative, obviously.
Yeah.
But the theme that came out the most often was like, so this is, I wrote this down. So it's, let me get this straight. If I commit a crime, it gets sentenced to jail time, but I identify as a toaster oven, will they put me on a shelf at my local Canadian Tire?
And yeah, it's, wow, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's like, it's so silly, and it's taking it to this absurd extreme. Also, yeah. I get where this person's coming from. But then you I guess if you stop and you ask yourself, what's the point of prison, of our prison system? Is it a place to lock people away forever who have done something bad, or is it a place to, I don't know, rehabilitate people? Then,
well, and I think too, someone like that maybe hasn't had the opportunity to hear someone's lived experience. Like, mm-hmm. there's an article released in 2016 where a transgender woman was housed in male quarters,
mm-hmm.
and had said that I had to undo 8 years yeah. of living as a woman.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be bullied and assaulted and discriminated yeah. against. So imagine the inner turmoil of mm-hmm. that individual.
Yeah. And it's like, do we, as Canadians, we often look to other countries and we say like, wow, those are inhumane conditions. Can you believe
it? Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And so yeah. we like, I guess it, as long as we can improve our process back home and kind of make it so that it's good for everybody.
I agree. Then, yeah. So that was a win for Canada. Woo, Canada.
Yeah. Great. A plus. Probably got it wrong in some way, but at least it's a step in the right direction.
At least it's a start. And yeah. as we said, there are going to be some growing pains and some lessons learned.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right. Well, this is, I hope the listeners.
Do you feel like you learned something from me, Simon?
I think that I learned something, but also more importantly, I understand how this policy piece plays in the larger Canadian science policy ecosystem.
Yes. Yes.
And it's just interesting to kind of see the stuff that we see, that we read on the news, and as scientists see how that relates to us, but also how it relates to these Canadian values of inclusion and of just not being jerks.
Yeah. It's, and you know, sometimes it's, you know, not thinking just of yourself.
Yes.
Yeah. Put yourself in that other person's position. And does it really affect, like, does it yeah. really impact you?
Exactly. Like, exactly. Okay. Well, I think this wraps it up for our first episode on policy, really how research is yeah. applied to policy. And so I learned a lot and I had a lot of fun.
And I had a lot of fun sharing my info with you, Simon. So what's up next? I'm curious to see what you'll have for me.
I'm also curious to see what we'll have next. But so next episode is going to be about, and this is something that haunts me. I swear, it haunts me to this day. I'm going to share with you my two biggest regrets from doing my PhD.
Masters. Oh, and wow.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. This is real talk.
Okay, I'm ready for this real talk. I want to hear it.
Yeah, so, and in it, there's actually a little bit of policy in there, too. So it'll be...
Okay.
I'm excited. And maybe if you think about it for a couple of minutes, you can share some of your regrets.
Oh, absolutely. If you have. I don't know if I have to think about it. I think I've they sit, like, right up front here.
All right.
Especially around grant writing time.
Yeah. So thank you for listening to this episode of Do You Even Science? If you liked it, feel free to please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. You can also subscribe on iTunes, we're on Stitcher. Dee and I got us everywhere. We're on Stitcher.
That's awesome.
We're on Google Play.
All right.
If you want to follow us on Twitter, we are... at @DYES_podcast, Do You Even Science? I'm at Dr. Simon Landry. Dina, what's your Twitter handle?
@ Dr. Dina M. Hamza.
Perfect. So now that you know how to get in touch with us, if you have any ideas of episodes, topics, things that you would like us to cover, please send it our way. And we look forward to being in your ear in a couple of weeks.
Until next time, Simon.
All right, until next time.